Hi, and welcome to this episode of The VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going where Max has not gone before. We're going to not to actually Mad Max's world, but Furiosa's world in the Mad Max universe. So, yeah, prequel if there ever was one. I'm joined by Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
I'm good. I'm ready to ride my. I don't know. I can't even.
and fresh off his chopper and desperately looking for Diesel is Jason Diamond. How are you?
Good. I am driving the last of the Great Interceptors.
Ah, yes, yes. In a in a non-hybrid world of
yes,
Interceptors and Mad Max. Okay, so this is a film that follows from a fairly successful Mad Max film in a way that didn't seem to resonate with audiences. So we're going to get into it both at a technical level in terms of the VFX work and also maybe some of the reasons that we think could be cultural, and it could be specific to this film, that really people pointed to Mad Max Furiosa as being disappointing at a box office level. And of course, box office isn't the only metric upon which one should judge a film by. There are loads of films that didn't do spectacular box office that are spectacularly good films and history has spoken very well of. But Matt, what do we think of the film just purely as a film before we sort of contextualize it in terms of its place in the demise of modern cinema?
I mean, you know, I'm a fan of certainly the original Mad Max and of Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. I think, you know, great cult classic movies that, you know, as a young person watching those, you know, in my high school years, I suppose. They're
one
just
of the great
so,
sequels, right up there with Godfather Part 2, Mad Max 2. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just so such a different kind of world building, and such an interesting voice and stylistic, you know, kind of sensibility in terms of the way things are shot. And they're just totally different. And so, at least in my mind as a young person, they were so Australian. I don't know if Australians would say that, but they certainly feel that way.
No. Yeah, Chris, the star of this film, said that
Hemsworth.
Chris said that we just call him Chris here. Chris said that Americans have Star Wars and the English have a boy wizard, and we have Mad Max, right? Like
that's cool. That's Mm-hmm. And I thought you know, the Tina Turner one, like, not so great, but
Thunderdome.
But I suppose it has its moments, right? And I mean, Tina Turner's cool, you know. You kind of have to give it up.
It was a product of its era in hairdos and
totally, yeah. It's
and
80s,
shoulder pads.
Yeah, mid to late 80s movie.
Those lost kids in that third film, I still think, is some of the best dialogue work I've ever seen. Like we discussed in a previous show, you know, in the Apes show, about people having difficulty with dialogue from a, you know, broken English point of view. If you haven't seen Mad Max 3, there's a sequence where there are these kids that have been isolated for a really long time, and they've grown up with only partial English. And their ability to speak in ways that we can understand but is no longer grammatically correct is just some of the best writing for
Captain
that.
Walker. Mrs. Walker.
Telling of the ways. Yes. Jason, what did you think of it as a film, Furiosa?
Well, Matt didn't get to his...
I was just going to say Fury Road.
Up or down.
The last one, Fury Road, so great. Like, I just think on a whole nother level, like just a totally different kind of cinema. And Furiosa certainly was excited to hear they were going to do it and sounded pretty cool. I really like Tom Burke, the actor who plays a smaller part in this. He's pretty fun to watch. And Anya Taylor-Joy kind of, you know, has been great in some of the movies she's been in. She's sort of an unknown commodity in this capacity. And so I was excited to see how that would come together. And on the tail of Fury Road, you know, the expectations were high. You know, I enjoyed it. You know, it's fun to watch, I guess, like, but it was eminently forgettable for some reason for me. I don't know. Like, it just didn't have the same power cinematically as Fury Road. And I think we could sort of get into maybe why, but.
Jason?
I'm going to answer Matt's question slightly. I think it's maybe a tad of prequelitis because we know that Furiosa doesn't die. So there is the lack of
stakes. Suspense. We didn't know she was going to lose her arm at some stage. So I spent most of the movie waiting for that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot of, I like the movie. It's not in the, you know, I won't rank them in order. It's not at the top of the list. But I enjoyed it. I love being in his world. I will take George Miller doing average movies over other people making what they think are good movies at times. So I'll leave that wherever it is. I had fun. Interestingly, and I will own this fault as a father on my part. My son had never seen any of the previous Mad Max movies.
Don't try and come into Australia. You'll be turned away at immigration.
I came in, I snuck in back in the fall and they didn't say anything. So they let me in. But, it was interesting for him to go into this movie without having any understanding of the world.
Right.
And I think you can, but there were things like the War Boys and all this stuff that me and actually his friend who went with us, who had seen Fury Road, were like, oh, like you're able to piece it together to understand where you are in relation to Fury Road. And he was like, I don't know what any of that. I mean, he enjoyed it, but he was like, it was from a different standpoint, which I found interesting. I kind of liked seeing all the different towns, Gastown, you know, the Bullet Farm.
It actually made more sense than Fury Road. Like this one actually kind of explained the geography much more. So you kind of actually understood why they were doing things and where they were going. I found in Fury Road, it was almost like, it was like an amusement park ride. I was so in, but at some point I have no idea why we're doing this, but it's great that we're doing it. Let's keep doing it.
Well, it was really only centered on the Citadel or whatever, you know, the Immortan Joe's thing. And it was only an escape film where this was like, Immortan Joe was kind of part of it. And he wasn't like a good guy, but he was kind of an impartial guy because we don't know he's a bad guy yet until you get to Fury Road. But the thing for me is that this contextualized Bartertown for me. Cause I was like, oh, right. Gastown, Bullet Farm, this Bartertown. Now all of a sudden Thunderdome makes sense to me, even though it did before, but in the Miller verse, it made sense to me. Like, oh, right, Bartertown makes sense. Why you would call it that?
I think it did a lot of that really well. I think there's three things that it did wrong as far as the reason why the box office didn't work. Firstly, I totally think it's a prequel problem. Like, it's just really hard to get behind a prequel, and it's the same problem that I've often talked about on this show where we go, hey, I know that Superman's not going to die, so he's in no peril. So as you said, why am I going to be on the edge of my seat, right? And I had that problem in The Matrix, right? Where I was like, no one's going to kill him, so he can do anything. And he's virtually, you know, impregnable, immortal, invisible, you know, it's like whatever. And then, so you just don't sit on the edge of your seat over drama. I also think there were some complicated problems with Chris Hemsworth, and they were this. I think Chris Hemsworth is brilliant. I really like him a lot. I think he went too comical, and he himself has apologized for the second Thor film, right? So he went too comical in that, too kind of like not taking the character that seriously. And so the audience sort of last impression of Chris Hemsworth is that kind of slightly slapsticky role, which we didn't really want him to be, and we wanted him to be more heroic. Then in this film, they stick a dumb nose on him and then make him a bad guy who's also a bit silly at times. And so it's like not the kind of Chris you want. It's the Chris you want is the hero, and you want him to be Thor, not the original, like, ignorant sort of no humor Thor, but definitely the first standalone Thor movie Chris. That's the one we like. Or you want him in Extraction where he's just a good guy, right? And you can really get him behind him killing, 100 other mercenaries as he tries to rescue the kid. Like, Chris is a bad guy with a funny nose. It's just like, it's really, he's got Aussie charm and it's like you're trying to work against that. So I think that was the second problem that the film had. And then the third problem you had is I actually think that the original actress of Fury Road, Charlize Theron,
yeah.
I was stumbling there, was so good that you're like, oh, she's not in it? Oh. It's not like, obviously, sensible to cast an actress that was younger for this, but she just owned that role so well. And I feel like she kind of owned it, the film, whenever she was on the screen in Fury Road so solidly that I was kind of disappointed that she wasn't here. And it's like, if you give me her film, I'd have gone and seen that more.
Okay, so two things. I had no problem with Anya Taylor-Joy as the younger Furiosa until, and spoiler alert, I didn't realize they were going to Rogue One this thing right into the beginning of Fury Road. So now you want me to believe that it's the same character, right? So that's the problem. I mean, again, I give George Miller a lot of leeway, more than I would give anyone else, because he's just doing his thing. It's his world. It's a unique thing. Fine. But that was one of the things that put me off. At the very end, I was like, wait, she's loading up the girls into the tanker, into the war rig. Yeah. Ostensibly, the next day, they're going to take off, and it's two different people. This is a soap opera problem. But, it didn't, break
Charlize
anything
Theron
for me.
Is just so good, though, on screen. She's a movie star.
I mean,
she's a movie star.
Yeah, and so is Anya Taylor-Joy, but putting them against each other.
Exactly, but it's a hard ask when you... Because your point is that they're in the same universe, in the same... Like, when you change Bonds, you kind of change different tone of Bond films.
Yeah.
So it's not my dad's Bond, it's my Bond kind of thing, right? This wasn't that, right? This wasn't a reimagining. This was, you say, it's like the other half that led up to it. And I just... Yeah. And I was like, well, why couldn't we have
also,
her?
But also, Bond is set up to be a little bit of like anybody could be Bond, kind of. It's the 007... I mean, it's kind of, they kind of trade on that a little bit when they switch guys, but the Hemsworth thing, I enjoyed his performance, but it felt like he was channeling Guy Pearce for me for some reason, but who I also love. But I agree with you, the comedy of his performance, I would rather have, because we don't have a bad guy like Immortan Joe. And like, we know Immortan Joe is bad because we see him in, and we kind of get it. I mean, we know he is in this one because there's people starving and whatever, but he's not the protagonist or the villain.
He's not driving the villain's plot.
Yeah. Yeah. Hemsworth is. He should have been more humongous than kind of, because Lord Humongous
he's scary.
Funniness. He's scary, but he's also in like bondage gear and a hockey mask. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like, it has its own silliness to it, but he transcends it because he's a big giant Swedish guy in Australia.
Chris didn't come off as demented the way that Dementus implies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although Hemsworth does do a Mel Gibson homage in this movie where he says, at one point, he says, if you want to get out of here, talk to me.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, wait a minute. That's that line. That's so good.
Okay. So from a visual effects point of view, what do we think? So I my points are like basically casting and big plot things, not quality of execution. Matt, take us to where do you think with SAT in terms of visual effects?
Visual effects wise, I mean, I was really curious, and I haven't done any research, but I was curious to know, and I don't know if you would know this, either one of you guys, but did the budget of this film, was it on par with Fury Road? Was it a higher budget? What, did they have less money? Like, because
it was 168, 170 mil, this one. I'll check on the budget.
So it's probably pretty close, but I mean, it felt like a lower budget. I will say, in some ways. There are some great set pieces in this. There are some amazing visual effects in it. There are some tough visual effects in here. And some of them, I think it's not so much, maybe.
Some of them, slightly less on the first one, on Fury Road. Like Fury Road, you know, who knows what the actual budget was, but somewhere between 150 and 180.
And yeah, I mean, it's in the same zone.
In the same zone. This is 168.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and I think there's some, I think, window replacements in this that are tough, like where it's like, why would that look so bad? Like, there's a few, like, you know, in car shots where they're putting stuff outside the window where I'm just like, what? Like, what am I looking at? Like, this is a final. Like, some of those were rough, I thought. And then some of the environments, are a little hard to believe, but I think it's not an effects problem with the environments, like the Immortan Joe, like whatever that thing is, the sort of
the
like
Citadel.
Monolithic rocks. And there's a scene in with the mother, and they're in this like chasm kind of, you know, and they're running through it. And that didn't really work geographically
from their utopian kind of Eden. You mean?
Yeah. There are some design problems that like it feels, which maybe isn't bad. It winds up feeling more like a fable, a storybook, which it even has those chapters to it, rather than the sort of gritty post-apocalyptic realism that I think you get in the other films. This one felt more fantasy and less like gritty in that same way.
I think Fury Road felt a little fantasy-ish. I mean, it was definitely a step outside of the first three films, for sure. I mean, granted,
I think the action in Fury Road felt more, integration of the actual live action, and then the integration of it with all the augmentation through the digital, you know, effects work that's done. Like it integrated really seamlessly. And I think there are moments where it hits that same intensity and the volume is kind of at that same level. And it's great when it works. I mean, it's really good. But there are parts too in this where I feel like it doesn't quite hit that same. I feel like it has to. Like it has to either outdo the last one somehow or have something that goes further. Like, because it's kind of part of what makes these movies so compelling, I think, for an audience.
I feel like this Fury Road was just so, you know, as I say, like unrelentingly action. Like it was just, there was no breath. It was just like this giant kind of, and this one does more world building, which I would normally really like, but I, to a sense, like maybe that's just not what the audience wanted, having gone, it's almost like if you'd swapped the order, you had the first film had the world building and established all the stuff. Then the second film could have been just a great action thing. And the things you needed to know, but clearly you didn't need to know them in Fury Road. So now you're going back and backfilling and telling me things that I could have used in Fury Road, but I didn't need to. So
I like that normally, but Charlize Theron in her Furiosa performance in the previous film, she shaved her head and Anya Taylor-Joy put on a bald cap. That wasn't very
well. Good. I saw an interview with her and she said she wanted to shave her head, and they were like, it's not going to work with the schedule. Like, we need you in hair at this point, but then we also need you bald at this point. And if you shave your head, we're
fine. It would have been better to rework the schedule.
To put a wig on.
The bald cap, like one of the things about a bald cap that doesn't work if you've got really long hair, which of course, as you can see, it works great on me.
But people listening to this can't see, but for the people listening,
I have no hair.
Matt has taken his hat off to show that he has a very, very pronounced
bald head.
Tight haircut.
Shaved. But like in the back of the neck, like you can see where like the geometry of the skull
shape isn't right.
Wrong. And so it's one of those things that like.
Andrew Jackson was the visual effects supervisor for this. Dean Egg did most of the work. Framestore did a bunch of stuff and Rising Sun did some stuff. And we'll get into that in a sec. And I think Paul Butterworth was on set. These guys, most of these people like Andrew, are all on Fury Road, right? This is not a different team. This is a lot of the same crew coming back. There's no budgetary staffing or even it was shot differently because for Fury Road, they had to go to Africa because Australia, for God knows what reason, maybe global warming, had suddenly sprouted wildflowers everywhere because it had rained. And so you couldn't have the... Now, that wasn't the case this time around. So they could shoot back in Australia in my home state, in which, by the way, my home state is like as big as most of Europe. But anyway, yeah, so in the dirt and dusk and stuff of Western New South Wales. Okay, so a different location there, but generally speaking, from a technical point of view, I think the stunt coordinator was the same on both films. I seem to recognize his name. So good teams, good people, good visual effects houses. So that stuff shouldn't come into play. Like, it's either directorial or... Let me ask
I think it's... Well, I was just going to say real quick, I think it's more what you were saying earlier is Fury Road is very simple, right? Mm. You get a setup in the beginning, and then she's driving the rig, and you're like, why isn't she stopping? What's happening? And then it's very linear. And then, of course, and the B story is Max, and then how he integrates into her story, and they help each other and whatever, and he says nothing. And that's... It's very easy to follow. There is no clear A to B. I don't think you're seeing her grow up. You're seeing her do this. You're seeing her do this. And that's fine. It's a first act of a three act trilogy because he wants to make the third one. And so, but we already saw the second act, right? We saw the exciting part of the second act. We're watching the first act, which is fine, but because we know it's really hard to do, and I think it's complicated for the audience.
I mean, we should point out that possibly the reason why Charlize Theron and didn't turn up to this one, and possibly I have no basis in fact for saying this, is other than rumors have it, and they're pretty industry legendary rumors, that her and Tom Hardy had a pretty hard time on the first film. They butted heads in no uncertain terms. Yeah.
I will say my brother saw a screening of this with a Q&A with George Miller and Hemsworth live afterwards. And George Miller said 100% I still to this day have no idea why, but that Tom Hardy refused to come out of his trailer most of the time. He's like, Charlize Theron was there every day on set, whether she was shooting or not. She's like, I'm here. I want to see what's going on. And they had to drag him. And I'm not, this is obviously not legit, literal, but he was, Miller just made supposition. He's like, I just think he was scared. And it was very difficult to get him out of his trailer to do the work, which again, I think that's what made them butt heads. Not that maybe they have I don't know any other information.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'm just saying, like,
he's there ready to swing and no one's pitching her the ball, you know?
On the scale of enjoyable shoots, it wasn't all,
of course,
roses and champagne. I will say this, like, the other reason that we're kind of a little harsh on this one is the Fury Road, and we sort of implicitly said this, it's a bloody good film. Like, it was nominated for 10 awards at the Oscars. It won 6. It won loads of other kind of, best action film of all time kind of stuff. So, they were up against a hell of a thing. Here's the thing. I want to swing hard into some visual effects now, because I don't want to miss... This film had some very different visual effects than what we've seen in either Fury Road or other things lately, not least of which is, you mentioned before, some of those characters. So the bullet farmer, who used to be played by Richard Carter, he'd passed away in 2019, right? So they had another character playing him, and Metaphysics replaced that actor's face. So Lee Perry played the new character, and Metaphysics replaced his face. So it was a synthetic version, effectively, of the bullet farmer. The bullet farmer, if you don't remember, it's the guy who has looks like a wig of bullets all over his, and he's a very kind of old, weather-beaten dude who was established in earlier films very solidly. And in Australia, much beloved actor, much beloved character. You really knew him and would not buy a character that kind of just was an actor lookalike. So that's pretty interesting. And I don't know, I even clocked that at the time. I don't know if you guys noticed that at the time, but I certainly
didn't
at the time.
No.
The other one that's super interesting, again, different visual effects that I want to discuss, is that the young Furiosa as a child, teenager kind of, you know, when she's like really, really young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So a younger actress played her, but they digitally modified her face to take on many of the appearances of the older actress that played Furiosa, Anya Taylor-Joy. So Rising Sun Pictures, who had done work on Thor, doing some face replacement stuff, the second Thor and a bunch of stuff, used their new machine learning techniques to not replace her whole face, because obviously that would look weird if you got Anya's face.
Kind of.
Yeah, mainly around the eyes and then a little bit around the nose and top lip to just make her look like a younger version of Anya. So the younger version of Anya has a lot more facial characteristics and in particular the eyes of the older actress. And again, I'd be interested to know what you guys thought about that. But
I mean, it
didn't jump out.
I had no idea. Like, I would not.
Yeah.
If you hadn't told me that, I would never have known, which is speaks volumes, I think, about how well done it was.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a really interesting trend in films, because in both of these cases, what we've seen, digital actors that have passed away, Carrie Fisher, you know, a whole lot of actresses, where mm-hmm. we've gone, oh, we need to make a digital version of her. Now what we're saying is you can make, and clearly I respect you guys enormously, I'm not just saying that, if you don't pick it, whereas you'd absolutely would have picked a digital Carrie Fisher when she was on screen, right? You might have thought it was really good, you might have thought whatever, but a digital version of a character, a fully digital version of a character, is incredibly hard to do right. And here we're taking not even a lead character, but you know, a character that's known, and doing a digital version of them when they've passed away, which is to say opening the door, but not from a CG point of view, from a machine learning inferred technique. And if that's buying as successfully as it seems to have done here, we're going to see that used. We're not going to see people going for CG versions. We're going
to
see them going for...
Is it similar to the what they did with Mark Hamill in, I can't remember what Star Wars show it was, but
it's a generation.
Mando.
It's a generation of technology after that. But yes, it's the same sort of approach. That was...
Because at the time, I think when we talked about that, like, you know, that was pretty impressive, you know, and you know it's not him.
But Mark's still alive and
right.
You can de-age somebody. Sort of, this is recreating that character in the film when the actor's passed. So that's why I didn't refer to him before. It's like Carrie Fisher's a better example, where Carrie isn't around to you know what I mean?
Well,
like
I think Mark Hamill, though, like
or Peter Cushing or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think in the Mark Hamill one, they had a younger actor stand
in
for him. And then they redid his face.
Yeah, when he's training Grogu. Yeah.
Yeah. And also secondary thing is this whole idea. Well, if you're going to have, you know, casting and you say, well, I really want that. Because I've many times in films, I've gone, oh, that's a really good likeness between the mother and the child. Like that child looks like that's mm-hmm. her mother, right? Or that looks like a good family resemblance. That's clearly down to casting. And casting agents go to a lot of trouble to find whatever those characteristics are in the face of an actor that makes you believe that they're a family member of another actor. We could be opening the door to a whole vast array of, hey, let's just take this actor that we really like and make them look a bit more like mm-hmm. their parents, or a bit more like the younger version of somebody in a flashback, which is what's happening here. Without doing a face replacement, just doing like a modification. I think we're going to see a huge amount of this kind of work coming through. Not that there wasn't a huge amount of work in this film, full stop, but it's just really, I just didn't know how much you guys zeroed in on that or not. Obviously,
I had read about it, about the Bullet Farmer, but more about Anya Taylor-Joy, because she had mentioned it in an article where she was saying that they had done like ostensibly a blend. In parts between her and the younger actress. Can I point out a sequence that I think is incredibly successful? And I think we agree that there's a lot that's successful in this movie, is the 15-minute truck sequence, like truck battle sequence, because that they shot that over 79 days for that 15-minute sequence. I think it works incredibly well. And referring again to the Q&A that my brother saw, George Miller said that was mostly second unit did that, and that he directed remotely from a monitor. Because he was not going to be in the desert for 79 days doing that.
That's a hell of a lot of consistency, isn't it, in lighting and stuff to make you... Because, I mean, getting consistency in a day is hard enough. Getting consistency over a week is, you know, very difficult. Over a month is impossible. Yeah. Over 3 months just doesn't seem even viable. Yeah, like that absolutely is incredible. I was going to... You'd mentioned earlier that sequence with the mother and the daughter and coming out of the canyon and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
While majority of the stuff was D-Neg, I believe that sequence was Framestore. And I'm going to check this because I'm hopefully talking to Andrew Jackson about this for an upcoming thing on FX Guide. But he's quoted as saying that in that sequence, at least I think it was Andrew that said this, there was 6,000 man days of roto on 240 shots because of flyaway hairs, fine details. They were all done without any blue screen or green screens. So for 240 shots, 6,000 man days of roto, which, by the way, I'm going to also say, sticking my neck out in no uncertain terms, boy, is that going to move into machine learning because...
I mean...
But yeah,
at least to get you 90% of the way there, you know.
Well, 90% of 6,000 days is worth having, right? Like, I don't know about you guys, but I was like, I mean, obviously, it wasn't one person sitting there for, you know, 6,000 days, it's man days, obviously, right? But still, like, as you say, if you get 90% of the way there, you get 5,400 man days done by the machine, and you just left with the last 600. Yeah. So, what other sequences did we, like there was a very complex scene at Bullet Town with the attack and the crane or digger sequence and stuff, which I thought that was a really good action sequence actually, and I thought it was good and intelligent use of not just trying to replicate the Fury Road. I mean, well, I love the chases, obviously, but that was a really nice thing that George Miller does really well, which is he knows where the audience is looking on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I think George Miller is like really, really good at this. And so not only have you got spatially what's going on, but I was watching it in IMAX. So it was huge.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
At a new IMAX theater. It was gorgeous, beautiful projection. But you never had that sense of like, wait, what's going on? Because something happened over there and something happened on the other side of screen. He knows if my eye has gone over to the left of screen for this, even though he's cutting to a completely different shot, which is the shot maybe of Chris Hemsworth's character trying to shoot or something, it's lined up so I'm well placed on the other side of that edit for what's going on. I think that was brilliantly edited, brilliantly conceived of in terms of choreography and, I guess, blocking. You know what I'm talking about with this giant crane and the...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, really moves the camera incredibly well. And again, I enjoyed the movie. I just... There's other movies that moved me more in the pantheon of Mad Max.
What did you guys think?
He always knows.
Oh, sorry. What? Oh, the time.
I was going to say he always knows where to put the camera.
But yeah, there's a time lapse building of the big rig. You know, when they're building the truck, and she's like learning how all this stuff gets built or whatever, and they do this like. It felt so different than anything in the rest of the movie. Suddenly there's this like time lapse thing. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. It was just a really different storytelling device cinematically.
Okay. Now, Matt, I'd be really interested in your opinion on this because I'm really conflicted by this myself in terms because I really admire George Miller and I admire his work and have for my whole bloody professional life. But he does this thing where he edits deliberately and films his productions deliberately in a way that I bump on, which is he speeds stuff up and he cuts frames out and drops frames out. And in fact, in Braveheart, because, you know, obviously Mel had learned from George Miller and he was directing in that case in Braveheart, he does the same thing. There's a sequence early on when his girlfriend / wife is about to be violated by some guards. And you'll see them go around the corner and Mel goes to do something and there's a drop frame to just accelerate the action to, and it, to me, I'm like, what? They just, what? There was a pop there, right? And the pop is because they literally cut frames out to have more impact, or somebody's going to be hit and you'd lose a frame. So the hit is faster and more sudden, even though it's not a locked off shot and it's not a visual effect shot. It's just, that's what they do.
I think
so. If you go to that sequence where she's going to cut her arm off, so she's been caught by Dementis, she's strung up and they've got her partner being swung around, trailed around her in a like cycling motion. Chris Hemsworth is sitting on top of a pickup giant truck ute thing, whatever you guys call it in America. And it's so clearly sped up that Chris's character, even though he's not doing much, has that twitchy thing where somebody gets sped up and they sort of like seem to move unrealistically. But it's not like your case of a time lapse where it's meant to be time lapse. It's just literally they're running the film bloody fast. I don't know. Does it bump you or not?
I actually think, okay, so I think this is a Mad Max Road Warrior, you know, it's a signature style. Mm-hmm. Like, it's part of the cinematic language of these movies. And like, whether it's like some really quick, you know, sped up, like zooming in to something on the roadway or a person in the, you know, driver's seat of the car, you know, some dramatic moment, like that stuff is so, it's so, or another one that's so common in those movies too, which sometimes has some subtle speed change and sometimes it's just the camera moving in and there's some, you know, there's a dark, ominous sky in the background. They're really brightly lit and their hair is kind of like blowing in the wind and we're moving in really quick up on their face. And it's really dramatic and the music crescendos kind of, you know, and I just think that that's a part of the world building, the melodrama kind of, for lack of a better term. I think it's kind of a melodramatic style that these films are made in. And it's a totally a George Miller thing, but it's, I think it's kind of cool. Like I haven't seen it and had it bother me. I saw the shot you're talking about where you see Chris Hemsworth and he's like kind of almost like Keystone copping or a little bit, you know, on top of the thing. But I kind of, I don't mind it. I just think like, well, yeah, okay, cool. Like,
yeah, it's like 18 world, frames a second or whatever. Yeah.
And it's the chaos of like everything that's happening, but then also that the cinematic process is sort of equally chaotic, you know, I think as it, we're watching like it's,
it. Yeah, it feels like something he learned in Mad Max because he never made a movie. That was his first movie. He was a surgeon before that and like wanted to make movies and stuff.
Well, and he didn't have the budget to do anything.
That's what I'm saying.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like he kind of used it there and then was like, I mean, I'm assuming, I haven't heard him talk about it, but like he obviously felt it worked. And I've heard him talk about or read articles where he talked about Road Warrior. And he's like, I had no idea what I was doing on Mad Max. And it took me until I made the Road Warrior where I felt like I even had a handle on anything, which is bananas because like, you know, you it's like P.T. Anderson making Hard Eight, and which is a tiny indie movie. And then he just makes his grand opus Boogie Nights. And all like all of a sudden he's a fully formed filmmaker. It's sort of the same for George Miller, but he doesn't, to your point, Matt, he doesn't ditch those, what might be first movie kind of tricks.
It's almost like you do it on the first movie because
you don't know
like,
what you're doing or you're learning.
Or because you don't have the coverage, you know, like you don't have what you need. Yeah. Like, so you're trying to get it to work.
I think
in the
Mad Max 1 to Mad Max 1 to Mad Max 2 is Terminator 1 to Terminator 2, right?
Yeah.
Like you love Terminator 2 and you think that Terminator 1 was even better than it was. Except if you go back and watch it, and you go, oh, that's a bit, you know. And then same with this, right? Mad Max 2 is so good that you go back to look at Mad Max 1 and you're like, oh, okay, that didn't quite have the thing, did it? But having said that, like it's still a very distinctive, like I agree with you, those massive crash zooms. There's a sequence, probably one of my favorite sequences of any action film ever, is Mad Max. Max is driving the truck. There's a guy who's gone up way up on the road and turned around and driving back towards him. So they're on a collision course. Meanwhile, there's a shotgun pellet on the front of the rig that Max is driving. And the audience is like confused in no way or shape or form between the drama of trying to get that pellet. Also, there's an impending car coming. Also, the windshield's been blown out. Also, everybody's under attack. It's just, it's like so wonderfully choreographed. And yet, in all of that, it's still surprising, original, and those mega crash rooms really, really work. But for some reason, you just said it yourself, Keystone Cops, right? It's a little comical in an area where I just felt comedy wasn't, I mean, I personally thought actually there was going to be a much better plot point to her putting the star chart on her arm. I thought someone was going to cut her arm off to get the star chart. Right?
Yeah, agreed. I did too.
You've gone to all this trouble to put the audience in the frame of mind if she's recorded on her arm and then she just leaves her arm behind.
Although what I got from it is she cut it off so no one did get it, even though there was no.
Was there any plot reason? I mean, that's a great rationalization.
Well, she was, they kept saying she was charting the stars to get home. Yeah. She realized she could tattoo, so she's doing it on her arm. And then she cuts off her arm to make sure no one else can.
But if that's true, you'd take the arm with you, or you'd cut the bit off of the map, but you're just left behind the arm.
I don't disagree with you. That was what I got, but
I
think
I digress. You
know, having someone who wanted it would be an extra little bonus. But I think to your point, though, let's look at the original three Mad Maxes. There's no CG. They're all very kind of bleach bypassy, very muted, desert, hot, like apocalypse movies, right? And then you get to Fury Road, which is like tons of color and like really like visually lush.
Especially that storm sequence, right? With that huge red
Fury Road. Yeah. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But it's a whole different thing. And there's clearly CG everywhere, which is fine because we're however many decades later, like, yeah, give the man his toolbox. But I think that the reason that the stuttery camera works better in the original is because it's part of a toolbox he's doing in a more real scenario. And when you get to Fury Road and Furiosa, there's so much digital effects and a broader worldview that maybe it quote cheapens the lower frame rate kind of. I mean, I don't think so, but I'm reacting to your reaction. Like it maybe takes it a step down in the toolbox out, even though it's part of the signature look. It feels maybe out of place. I mean, don't think it does. But
he did it in war. The beginning of Fury Road, he did the same thing, right? When the war boys first rush to get out of the complex and like it's in the first few minutes of the film, right? And it takes off. He did the same thing. He used to jump or drop edits or whatever you want to call it to accelerate that. And I agree that it's less of a bump for me there because it felt like it was insane and almost like overwhelming how much like this was sort of like happening. So the rushing nature of it kind of worked. I don't know. I just felt like that one.
But that's
sequence,
a claustrophobic shot. That's not a like a big right. That's like the interior.
But it's the locked off shot of him on sitting on the monster truck where they're running around sped up. That I was like, why are we? And then you're right on Mad Max. They weren't doing visual effects on Fury Road. They were changing the shadows on the ground to make it consistent for the trucks and no doubt doing the same thing on this one. So it's clearly not an accident. It's clearly a deliberate stylistic choice. But for me, I just bump on it. And that's, you know, from somebody that I think is just brilliant. And, you know, Simon Duggan, the DOP, and all the people involved in this are really on the top of their game. They're really good people. So yeah, it's obviously a stylistic choice. I just don't like that stylistic choice.
Sometimes you're wrong, Mike. It's okay.
It's my emotion. It's valid. I think that you need to acknowledge that it's valid for me.
I think another thing that I thought in this film that like, you know, there again, there's some great sequences in it. There's some great effects in it. There's some, I think, some problems story-wise. I think the Hemsworth thing you mentioned earlier, I would just say, like, if he just leaned full into being, like, just a straight-up really bad guy, like, a total, like, that would have been cool. He would have been scary. And how fun for an actor who's so beloved to play a super villain. But he played the villain kind of tongue in cheek in a way. And that's, I think, what doesn't work. But the other thing that I thought was, because I'm sort of watching this movie and it comes so close on the heels of Fury Road, which I think really hit the reset button on the whole, this whole franchise of movies, right? It came out, it was so big, so bombastic, so saturated color and like huge, you know, beautiful world building going on. And then this film comes so close on the heels of it. And it has moments where it sort of like starts to get to that level of Fury Road, but it isn't consistent enough. And I think what was actually hit at home, which is so weird, is when the movie ends, like you were saying, Jason, it dovetails right into the same narrative. And then we're watching all these clips from Fury Road as the credits roll.
Yeah.
And I'm
thinking
like, yeah, that's a way better movie. I'm watching the movie that I really like now in the credits, but I just watched a movie that like should have been,
which I found weird. I found that a weird choice.
Yeah.
Show the Fury Road stuff there.
But can I also point out, as saturated and as different Fury Road was, let's not skip past the black and chrome version of Fury Road, right?
Oh, of course,
just drippingly gorgeous without any saturated red colors. It was like, not black and white, black and chrome.
Yes.
Which, by the way, a listener had texted us on Mastodon or sent us a note. I should look and see if I can see it here, but about, had we watched
the chrome? Yeah,
had we had a chance to watch the monochrome version of Godzilla Minus One, Godzilla Minus Color.
That's what it was called. Yeah.
I have not seen that. I will check
I didn't,
out.
Although my friends who had said that they Alec didn't Perkins. Feel that it was as successful because there's just, because there's a lot of specific color reference in the movie of like the different, the rate, like the breath and stuff. That's a personal choice.
Can I say one other thing about getting back to this? I also think, and I alluded to this earlier, that you had such strong original visuals in Fury Road that you had to have them again here because it was the same place. But like those guys on the poles in Fury Road and the guy with the guitar with the giant Marshall stack and the kind of
Doof Warrior,
with the flame throwing and stuff, like that was some badass cyberpunk.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, and the guys on the poles, like I'd never seen that before. And you were we're not talking about CG guys on poles here. These are guys on poles. And it was like, oh my God, like that seemed to come from a mind of a genius that had come from an original kind of thing. And of course, you're not going to get that again because it can't look like it's completely original and I've never seen it before if it's meant to be the same goddamn place and the same darn people. But it was breathtaking in Fury Road when I saw those things, right? They were just so cyberpunk cool that, you know, it's like, oh, yeah. So then you were never going to have that second reaction because I'd already seen them. So, you know, in a sense, it was never going to match some of those aspects.
It's just a world building problem. Yeah. Like it's just the plot can't be strong enough to support the, because it's a prequel.
But in this context, note that we've not really been pulling apart visual effects shots, right? Like the amount of visual effects in this, which is astronomical, and the amount that you don't notice them. I mean, okay, there was a couple of comments about window shots, but like there is so much. Like this was, and here's another thing that's really interesting. This is coming from supervisor Andrew Jackson, whose previous film, you might remember, Oppenheimer, had the, you know, honor of remarkably restrained visual effects to the point that, you know, we were all like, wait, couldn't we actually see an atomic bomb go up because it would be kind of more fun? Andrew being incredibly practical as well as a visual effects guy, like, you know, really happy to get his hands dirty and come up with inventive things. But Andrew's work couldn't, or the films could not be more different that he's delivering here in Oppenheimer and the previous films that he's done. Like that, which were just really, really like, in camera to the point of almost absurdity. And now a film that just embraces every digital technology and even ones that, you know, we weren't picking. It's kind of a pretty diverse range of talents for a guy there.
Yeah. I mean, I would, at no point do I feel like that there's no, I mean, there is peril in every scene. You know, they're driving, they're this. At no point do I think they're not driving or like I spot whatever, right? Like, I mean, we know from BTS and Fury Road, they shot a ton of stuff. The truck is parked and they got fans and they're doing other shit. And because it's too dangerous to do what they need to do on a truck hurtling through the desert. So, but at no point in Fury Road are you like, that truck's not moving. No, like, and it's the same here. I mean, I did not at any point feel that the vehicles and the explosions and all the guys flying off and everything was, it didn't, there was no wall breaking.
Yeah. Dean Egg brought its A game, right? I mean,
yeah, for sure.
Dean Egg did so much work here that we're not even discussing. That's sort of almost, you know, cruel, but yeah, I mean, it's just a very, very dense visual effects film with a lot of great delivery. But it's just, I guess, a shame that it didn't resonate more with an audience. And there's probably a bunch of reasons we haven't articulated that why that was. But I, you know.
But it's also been, it hasn't been, I feel like they movies used to be left in the theater for a month, 2 months, like to sort of do their thing.
They marketed it pretty hard, Jason. They
marketed it. No, of course. Of course.
Chris Hemsworth, a star on the Hollywood Walk of
Fame. Yeah, yeah.
They had Robert Downey Jr. there to like, you know, to sort of cement the star-powered nature of it all. Mm-hmm. They had a parade up and down Hollywood, whatever that road is, but My Man's Chinese Theater. They did all the Tonight Shows. They were like doing stuff. They did a heap of stuff here in Sydney.
No, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think there was no lack of like, but if the audiences aren't there, having said that, as we're recording this, you know, things like Inside Out 2 are doing gangbuster business at box office, mm-hmm. which is great, right? So it's not, can't be put down to the fact that no one goes to cinemas. It may hardly be that.
I think that's a false narrative. That's a false narrative. I don't think that's true.
Okay, well, that kind of wraps it up for this show. But again, thank you guys so much for listening. And thank you, Matt and Jason, for you know, arguing with me and insulting my Australian heritage and my Australian... but anyway, seriously, it was...
We witness you, Mike.
Thank you. Hey, Matt, where can people connect with you? And you already mentioned that we've been following on some comments from Godzilla, but where can people connect if they want to put in comments?
Yeah, I'm just everything that links to my wherever I participate in stuff is on my website at mattwallen.com.
And Jason?
TheDiamondBros.com, Jason Diamond as one word, and the social medias, and you know, wherever you see two twins wandering around.
And with any luck, by the time this you hear this, I'll have recorded the pickup with Andrew. I spoke to Andrew; he was on holidays after having done this, and we been connecting calendars. But I'm looking forward to going an in-depth discussion with Andrew Jackson about the film, and really focusing on the great visual effects that we've been talking about in the show. Mm-hmm. Until then, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for listening, guys. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.